Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Fiona Hill, the director of the Center on the United States and Europe and a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and co-author of Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. We'll discuss how much Putin sees the current crisis with Ukraine through the lens of a former KGB colonel. Then we will speak with a former senior advisor to the United Nations Secretariat and a foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the State Department, David Phillips, who has an article at the Huffington Post, Putin's Calculus in Ukraine. We will discuss concerns expressed by Russian-speaking Angela Merkel after a long phone conversation with German-speaking Vladimir Putin that the Russian leader is in his own world, believing that Russia's problems with Ukraine are caused by CIA and U.S. meddling, not a rejection of Russia's corrupt and criminal model of governance personified by the deposed Yanukovych family regime. Then finally, we will hear from Toby Miller, one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to everyday life. We will discuss this year's winners in the Academy Awards that seem to reject politically themed documentaries like The Square and Dirty Wars, and movies with political and social content like American Hustle, The Wolf of Wall Street, and Nebraska, in favor of a special effects-driven Gravity. And joining us now is Fiona Hill, director of the Center on the United States and Europe and a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. She is a frequent commentator on Russia and Ukrainian affairs and Eurasian affairs and has researched and published extensively on issues related to Russia, the Caucasus, Central Asia, regional conflicts, energy and strategic issues. She's also the co-author of the new book, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fiona Hill.
Thanks, Ian.
And what is your sense then of the extent to which Vladimir Putin sees what's happening in the Ukraine through this lens of a former KGB colonel? And what I'm told by Russians that I've spoken to is that he honestly believes that this is all the work of the CIA and not a rejection of this model of governance personified by the Yanukovych regime.
I think it's actually the case that Vladimir Putin has believed for a very long time that many of the conflicts and upheavals in the former Soviet Union have been managed and instigated from the outside. It's not just the situation in Ukraine right now over the last several weeks and months, but it's also the so-called color revolutions that took place in Georgia, Ukraine, and to some extent Kyrgyzstan in the earlier parts of the 2000s. And Putin's approach to this has obviously been very much shaped by his worldview and his experience in the KGB at a time when, indeed, as we know, during the Cold War, the CIA was engaged in a certain amount of subterfuge and subtervention, and indeed in a certain amount of intervention in other countries' political situations and in different conflicts. So Putin has just assumed that state of affairs has continued, and in part that's probably heightened by the continuation of the intelligence, counterintelligence interactions between Russia and the United States. And we've had a lot over the last several years about spying, mutual spying. Obviously, Vladimir Putin has in his possession right now Edward Snowden, who's been making all these revelations about the NSA, and that can only have fueled Putin's perception of what the United States is up to. And then there's been all of the back and forth on sleeper agents and various efforts at recruitment. You remember that Putin unmasked a bunch of British spies in Moscow who were engaging in dead drops and relished that. So as far as he's concerned, nothing has really changed. And when he looks at Ukraine and he looks at developments in Georgia or in any of the other countries in the region, he sees the long and very heavy hand of the United States and the CIA and generally of Western intelligence meddling in his neighborhood.
Well, I know a lot of people on the left think that the CIA is behind everything. But in the real world, intelligence agencies, this may not apply to Russia because it's run by a former intelligence agent, and most of the cronies that are running the place seem to be former KGB people. But the intelligence agencies don't have that much influence over the bigger issues of the economy, geopolitics, and governance. And I'm wondering whether even with the case of John Kerry going to Kiev, that strikes me as being something of a mistake. Why didn't he go straight to Moscow? I mean, why can't we find ways to? I mean, I believe Angela Merkel tried to counsel Putin in that long conversation that the CIA is not out to. They're not behind everything. But why do you think Kerry's – I mean, do you think that Kerry showing up in Kiev is just going to inflame the situation in Putin's eyes?
Well, it could well do that. I mean, right now we've got to figure out how do we address this paranoia and this high level of distrust that Putin has towards us and to the world, the West in general. I don't think he is per se anti-American or anti-Western, but he does perceive a real threat. And you actually said something very important there, Ian. I mean, Putin is pretty unique in the whole realm of world leaders right now. He is the only person who has come from the shadows as an operative from the organs of the state that were really beyond the scrutiny and beyond the oversight of politicians or of the public. There is no one else like him out there at the top of a government. And he then brings this particular worldview to things, and we also, ourselves, don't understand how to address that. I mean, Angela Merkel, for one, comes from East Germany, where she was basically subject to the intervention, the subterfuge, and the manipulation of the Stasi. She and her family suffered, like many other East Germans, from that overbearing police state and the role of the intelligence services there. And she probably, although she understands the general mindset, she can't quite reach Putin on that particular level. I mean, Putin, when he looks around the world, I mean, again, he really does seem to think that the institutions that we have oversight over in the West, that are actually open there, especially, as I say, the situation with Edward Snowden must really have encouraged this thinking on his part even more, that they're really behind the scenes call the shots. And in a way, that's also mirror imaging because, as you've pointed out, he has a very tight, informal network of people around him actually do run Russia. It's not the state institutions that do so, and many of them do have a security service background. So we have to really understand his worldview, but unfortunately, the paranoia and this distrust that we have is not easily addressed, and it's going to take an awful lot of work on the part of the Germans, on the part of many of our leaders overall to try to dispel this, but it's going to be a very, very difficult situation.
And again, I'm speaking with Fiona Hill, who's the director of the Center on the United States and Europe and a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution. She's a frequent commentator on Russian and Eurasian affairs, who has researched and published extensively on issues related to Russia, the Caucasus, Central Asia, regional conflicts, energy and strategic issues. She's also the co-author of the new book, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. But already, the markets have Russian stocks have taken a beating. They've lost about $60 billion in stock value just in the course of a day, which is more than what the Sochi Olympics cost. Gazprom has lost $15 billion in one day, which is the same amount that Putin had pledged to Yanukovych. Is that getting through to Putin, do you think?
Well, again, very sadly, whenever things like this happen, there's also a tendency coming out of the Kremlin to accuse the West of, you know, somehow trying to subvert the Russian economy. And, of course, all the discussion that we're having here about sanctions, and frankly, you know, sanctions would have an impact on Russia and on the Russian economy if they were the kind of sanctions that we've imposed against Iran, where we, you know, we've stood in lockstep together with the EU, and those sanctions have had a big impact on certainly the Iranian economy and to some degree on the sentiment of you know, the Ukrainian leadership in deciding to go again for a negotiation with the West. But, you know, from the Russian point of view, this is all the effects of punitive action. This is double standards. This is something that we're doing again to try to subvert Russia from the inside. And we were really in a very delicate situation here. The Russians perceive a real threat from the developments in Ukraine. And Putin is the kind of person who finds it very, very hard to believe that these are spontaneous, you know, grassroots developments. I think he's also brought in the narrative that the people around him have been spinning about extremist neo-Nazi factions who are orchestrating all of this, about the fact it's a coup that was perpetrated against Yanukovych. And he doesn't see at all that this is, you know, really the expression of a vast swathe of the Ukrainian population of protest against the way that the country was being governed. Again, he thinks that people were paid to go out onto the square in the streets of Kiev to protest and to overthrow the government. He doesn't believe that people spontaneously organize themselves and, you know, raise money themselves through sort of crowdsourcing to be there. And there's many people in Russia who share that same conspiracy theory, and as you've pointed out, many people here who also believe the same thing. I've heard the same comments from Putin passed around by Western observers, you know, as I've been out and about today.
So, given how much the propaganda machinery that Putin runs in Russia has demonized what's happening, or demonized the opposition, who are now a government, even though they seem to be in a state of shock. And I spoke yesterday with an independent defense analyst in Moscow, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who took the position that Putin was kind of a czar, acting imperiously and recklessly, and that that in the short term he may be able to cower that country, but in the other, in the long term, it could have some grave consequences. That the Ukrainians do feel strongly and are very nationalistic. And my understanding is that even inside Russia, the, what polling is available, apparently the Russian people, even though they've been propagandized, they're not apparently thrilled with the idea of war.
No, I mean, there's nobody in the Russian setting who would have any support whatsoever for a war with Ukraine. Ukraine's a very different matter from Georgia. I mean, one of the difficulties we have here, that the narrative that's coming out of Moscow is talking about the fraternal people of Ukraine. They're even Putin has actually even said we're one and the same nation. And, you know, this is obviously based on the Russian language acquisition of a, you know, very large swathe of the population in Ukraine. But we know from many other settings that just because you speak a certain language doesn't necessarily you mean that you identify with the larger group that that language belongs to. I mean, there are many places across the world that speak English, but, you know, have a very different set of identity. Scotland is, you know, a case in point, but, you know, we'll see what happens with the Scottish referendum in September. So the calculation that all Russian speakers in Ukraine, or the vast majority of them, are somehow in favor of being joined with Russia has to be put to the test. And if indeed that leads, as Dr. Felgenhauer was suggesting, in the direction of an open conflict, and that shots are fired on the part of Ukrainians and Russians in a conflict with each other, that will change public sentiment quite dramatically in Russia. Right now, Putin is benefiting from an uptick in his popularity and his poll ratings as a result of Sochi. He knows that everybody on the outside doesn't want to have a conflict over Ukraine and is in a considerable state of disarray. He's taking advantage of the fact that the Ukrainians haven't held an election for a new government. And so right now they're in a way ungoverned, and they're cobbling together basically an acting administration until elections can be held for a new president. And he's playing with the fact that President Yanukovych, the deposed president of Ukraine, is now in Russia, and they can, you know, use Yanukovych's presence to also justify and legitimize, at least in public opinion at home and, you know, perhaps to some degree elsewhere, the actions that they're taking in defense of the legitimately or the legally elected government of Ukraine that was overturned and is represented by Yanukovych. So, I mean, there's a lot going on here. There's a great deal of complexity. There's a great deal of uncertainty. And I think, again, Pavel Felgenhauer is right that, you know, Russia and Putin in particular cannot guarantee that they can be in complete control of events and of sentiment on the ground in Ukraine as we go forward. And this could have some blowback and some repercussions for Putin at home.
Well, already the UN, Russia's UN representative has held up a letter to the Security Council from Yanukovych saying that he's asked for Russian military intervention in Ukraine.
Well, exactly. And I think that's kind of part of the problem that we're facing. And Putin also went to the Federation Council, the upper house of the Russian parliament, and essentially got a blanket approval, in effect, really mirroring what President Obama was trying to do in terms of putting the situation in Syria to a vote to the houses of Congress and the Senate in the United States, you know, so many months ago. But this time, Putin was pretty sure that he was going to get approval, and he got it, essentially justifying taking some form of action in defense of Russian speakers and Russian citizens across the whole territory of Ukraine. So, you know, opened up the possibility of moving beyond Crimea to some other points, at least in Ukraine. And the speculation right now is that it may be in some of these cities with a predominantly Russian-speaking population, like Donetsk or Kharkiv, which are in the far eastern part of Ukraine.
Well, but the evidence of Ukrainians, I mean, the best evidence, and it's and is about this idea of overturning Yanukovych's decree about Russian language speaking, and which the new government, even though it's not even really a government, have subsequently rescinded. That's the only evidence of any anti-Russian discrimination. The people who are being beaten up are Ukrainians who are opposing Russian intervention, and the people who have been shot have been Ukrainians who've been shot by their own government. So as far as I can tell, there's no evidence of discrimination against Russian speakers, and the logic by which Putin is operating, which is I have to defend Russian minorities, could extend to the Baltics and throughout the entire former Soviet Union.
Well, this is also a line that was used prior to Putin. It's actually been a long-standing policy of the Russian government since the Yeltsin period, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, you know, back in 1991, to exert the right to protect the interests of Russian speakers, not just of Russian citizens in the neighboring countries. It was indeed, as you point out, a factor in the Baltic states throughout the whole of the 1990s, but also in places like Transnistria, the secessionist republic of Moldova, in Abkhazia, in South Ossetia, you know, the secessionist republics of Georgia, and again in Ukraine. We've been living with this for an awfully long time. It was back actually in 1992 when Russia first started to assert that right to basically protect the interests of Russian speakers. So Putin is playing along here on a very long-standing practice, Russian insistence on the legality of the Russian language. And there are many parts of the former Soviet Union, including Kazakhstan, many of the countries with the large Russian-speaking populations that have played backwards and forwards with various language decrees. As you said, it was only Yanukovych who introduced this language ruling quite recently, in fact, to curry favor with the Russian-speaking population in the east of Ukraine. But it's also, again, not just a divisive issue, but also something that's very misleading, because there's a huge swathe of the Ukrainian population of people who think of themselves as ethnically Ukrainian who speak Russian. I mean, if you go to Kiev, you hear Russian spoken just as much as you hear Ukrainian. I have many friends who are Ukrainian who speak only Russian. And also, you know, Ukrainian-speaking Ukrainian friends who say that they spend all of their days speaking Russian. So this is, in many respects, a red herring issue. It's used deliberately for the process of political manipulation.
But you mentioned Kazakhstan, which is a part of this union that Putin is offering in competition to the EU, and which is began this whole zero sum situation with Ukraine. The foreign minister of Kazakhstan says Kazakhstan expresses deep concern over the developments in Ukraine and calls on all sides to stop the use of force in the resolution of this situation. It doesn't sound like Kazakhstan is too thrilled about what's happening.
No, they shouldn't be, because, I mean, the extension of the logical extension of what's happening in Ukraine could soon be visited in Kazakhstan. The president of Kazakhstan, Nursultan Nazarbayev, is getting older. Everybody's focusing on what comes next after Nursultan Nazarbayev. So there must be great concern in Astana, the capital of Kazakhstan right now, about what Russia will do if they don't like the regime, the administration, the government, or the leader who succeeds Nazarbayev. Will they then claim the same right to protect Russian speakers and Russian citizens in Kazakhstan? And the whole part of northern Kazakhstan was settled not just by Russians, but Ukrainians, Belarusians, a whole host of people from around the Soviet Union. It's part of the old virgin lands that were settled under Khrushchev period, and the people there are predominantly Russian-speaking. A large part of the Kazakh elite only speaks Russian. So the point is, a lot of people will be wondering, where does this stop? And even if our relationships with Russia are good now, how far is Vladimir Putin and others going to push things if they don't like the turn of events on the ground in our republic as well?
Well, just in closing, Fiona Hill, I was quite alarmed by what Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer said yesterday. And are you worried that this could get out of hand?
Well, there's always a risk on every side for miscalculation. I mean, we run the same risks ourselves. I mean, we're basically, as we started off at the very beginning, dealing with someone who has a very different worldview from our own, one that isn't always understood. We don't have the same frame of reference when we talk about the same concerns and the same sets of issues. And in that case, the whole propensity and the whole tendency towards misunderstanding has already been made very clear. And Vladimir Putin and the people around him have also made it extremely evident that they see what was happening in Ukraine on the ground as a real risk, as a real threat to them and a threat to their interests, and that they've been prepared to take some fairly drastic action in the defense of those interests. And so we're not going to see Putin back down. He's not the kind of person who backs down. I think we're going to be in here for the long haul, and we're going to be dealing with a situation in Crimea and in other parts of eastern Ukraine that's going to unfold very rapidly and is going to be a massive challenge for us for the foreseeable future. And it's going to greatly complicate every effort that we've been having to find a way of dealing with Russia directly.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Fiona Hill.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Fiona Hill, who's the director of the Center on the United States and Europe and a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution. She's a frequent commentator on Russian and Eurasian affairs who has researched and published extensively on issues related to Russia, the Caucasus, Central Asia, regional conflicts, energy and strategic issues. She's also the co-author of the new book, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into Putin's calculus in Ukraine.
War is not the answer. Politician and them bobo niggas in here. War is not the answer. I'm thinking over the solution. Rasta says, war is not the answer. Tell the politician and them start drop them bomb. War is not the answer. I'm thinking over the solution. Rasta says, war is not the answer.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and author of Losing Iraq: Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He has worked as a senior advisor to the United Nations Secretariat and as a foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the United States Department of State, and has an article at the Huffington Post, Putin's Calculus in Ukraine. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And what is Putin's calculus? Because I had a very alarming conversation yesterday with the defense analyst in Moscow, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who indicated he thought that Putin was behaving recklessly in this whole misadventure. And if he goes deeper into Ukraine, it could blow up in his face and cause untold destruction and mayhem and death and, name it. So what do you think Putin's calculus is?
It's true that he's acting recklessly. He's delusional at times, but he is fundamentally cold and calculating. And Vladimir Putin has a plan. He wants to restore Russia's control in parts of the former Soviet Union. And he's starting in Crimea. He's made it clear that the greatest tragedy of the 20th century was the demise of the Soviet Union. So ethnic Russian areas in the so-called near abroad right now are fair game to Russia and to Putin.
Well, but does this mean he's going to intervene further militarily in Ukraine?
He could very well. There's a Russian belt in between Donetsk and Kharkiv. Going into Crimea, where they already had a base agreement, is one thing. But if he does what the Russian Duma has authorized him to do, which is to extend Russia's military deeper into the country, then you're likely to see a real military confrontation between Ukraine and Russia.
And that's what Felgenhauer was telling me yesterday, that that could end up a massive disaster, worse than the conflagrations we're seeing in Syria and other parts of the world.
I mean, so far in Kiev, they've been restrained in their actions. But if Russia comes in to tries to take territory beyond Crimea, there will be a lot of pressure on this interim government to demonstrate a military response. You know, they're likely to get wiped in the battlefield because Russia's forces are so much greater and they spend so much more money than Ukraine does. Now, how does the international community respond if Russia decides that it wants to seize all of the ethnic Russian territories and there is a live fire exchange between Ukraine and Russia over those lands?
So that would lead me to believe that, given what you said about Putin, that he's cold and calculating, that he's not going to go that far.
If he thinks he can get away with it, he will go that far. And we also need to put this in a bigger context. I mean, what's the ultimate end game here for Vladimir Putin? Is it simply Crimea? Is it the ethnic Russian territories in Ukraine? Is he trying to embarrass the United States and President Obama? And what about other countries in the former Soviet Union where there are ethnic Russian populations, like Moldova and Georgia and the Baltic states? Unless you draw a line and you keep Putin and Russia from aggressing further into Ukraine, what's going to stop them from continuing their aggression and trying to take other territories?
Well, apparently there were concerns expressed by the Russian-speaking Angela Merkel after a long phone conversation with the German-speaking Vladimir Putin that the Russian leader is in his own world, believing that Russia's problems with Ukraine are caused by CIA and U.S. meddling, not a rejection of Russia's corrupt and criminal model of governance personified by the deposed Yanukovych family regime. And that being the case, then why does Secretary of State Kerry, why is he flying into Kiev? You don't want to increase Putin's paranoia. He should be flying into Moscow, shouldn't he?
And Putin is paranoid. He thinks this whole thing is a Western conspiracy and that the anti-Russian opposition is sponsored and backed by U.S. and Western intelligence. And what's important right now is to just lower the temperature, try to stabilize the situation, keep things from escalating. Tactically, to go to Kiev first sends a signal of strong support to Ukraine. But we have an important bilateral relationship with Russia. And if we want them to stand down, we have to make very clear what the red lines are and then what the costs are going to be. So going to Moscow and having a sit down with Russian officials and letting them know what the implications will be to this action, it's very important for the United States.
But my understanding is that Putin has almost disdain for Obama, whether he thinks Obama is weak because he sort of ran rings around him over Syria, or it's possible that it's even tinged with a certain amount of racism. What's your understanding of Putin's attitude to Obama?
Whenever they've met, the body language has been pretty clear. Putin looks like a schoolboy in the back of the classroom. He really has no interest in an engagement with Obama. So I think that there's a personal disdain. Also, there's a tinge of racism there. And it's widely known that African exchange students in Moscow get rounded up and beaten by skinheads. There's no love between Russians and Africans or African Americans. So part of Putin's contempt for President Obama is also the fact of President Obama's race.
Well, because he's Putin's a friend in the Duma, who's also a former, she lit the Olympic torch. She tweeted that racist picture of Obama and his wife. I don't know whether you saw it, holding up a banana.
Yeah, I did see it. It was disgusting and there was no place for it, and she should have been more than reprimanded. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that kind of attitude is widespread in Russia. And as long as Putin and his circle are allowed to get away with this kind of action in Crimea, they're going to continue to aggress and try to restore Russia's imperial ambitions in what they call the near abroad. It gets really dangerous if Russian forces go into other ethnic Russian parts of Ukraine, because then they're on a roll. And if they're not stopped there, they'll go into Moldova and maybe the Baltic states. And then you've got NATO involved, and there's a real potential for this to turn into a major conflagration.
Again, I'm speaking with David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Liberating Kosovo, Coercive Diplomacy and U.S. Intervention. He's worked as a senior advisor to the United Nations Secretariat and as a foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the United States Department of State. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Putin's Calculus in Ukraine. That sounds pretty alarming, and I can't see how. First of all, when you say he's got getting away with what he's doing in Crimea, it looks like he has gotten away with it, unless, as Pavel Felgenhauer was saying yesterday, somehow the minority Tatars end up, you know, going to guerrilla warfare over the long haul. At this point, he's completely controlled Crimea without firing a shot. And if he goes into Ukraine, as we were saying earlier, there's likely to be a tremendous response from Ukrainians, and that could begin even in the short term. The Russian military could overwhelm the very weak Ukrainian military, but in the long term, you would have a terrible situation. And even polling in Russia itself indicates that the Russian people are dead against the idea of war. They feel very close fraternal ties with the Ukrainians.
Well, let's just be clear that Crimea is part of Ukraine.
Right.
And let's also be clear that Putin is in complete control.
Right.
He's been able to occupy Crimea without firing a shot. The Ukrainian forces there are surrounded. What's the West going to do? It needs to have an economic, a political, and a security response. The government in Kiev is bankrupt. So they need an IMF package to shape up sooner than later. Politically, William Hague went to Kiev today to show support. Kerry will go as well. There's a possibility of bringing Ukrainians to Washington and also developing a democracy assistance package to try to compensate for the democracy deficit that exists in Ukraine. But it's important that this whole conflict not look as though it's between the United States and Russia. It should be between Russia and the international community. And that's where NATO has a very important role to play. It can speed up negotiations around a membership action plan for Ukraine. It can extend air patrols over Ukrainian airspace. It can deploy monitors as a kind of tripwire in the event that Russian troops decide they want to go further than Crimea. The U.S. can send high-level defense officials to look at Ukraine's military capabilities and explore ways that they could be strengthened. So there's a lot that can be done.
Right, but everything that you've mentioned, David Phillips, in the context of what we talked about earlier with the Secretary of State Kerry showing up in Kiev instead of showing up in Moscow, that we shouldn't be playing into Putin's paranoia. Everything that you just enunciated will add to his paranoia, 10,000-fold. I mean, the idea of NATO, he keeps thinking that this is all about NATO, and NATO expansion into Ukraine is not even on the table, but the idea that NATO would have a plan and start sending planes and advisors and stuff, wouldn't that absolutely, first of all, it would validate all of what Putin is saying and ramp up his paranoia to a dangerous degree?
So it's hard to square the circle. You have to guard against Putin's paranoia, but you also have to show resolve and character in the face of aggression. And the U.S. and NATO are in a position to do that. And let me be very clear, if you don't establish red lines and you don't enumerate specific costs so that when you threaten Putin with some painful action, he knows exactly what to expect, then he's just going to go on a roll. And there's no stopping that. So I'm more worried about drawing a red line and showing solidarity with pro-democracy forces than exacerbating Putin's paranoid personality.
So then do you think that your suggestions are being proffered in the White House? I mean, Netanyahu was there today with the president. Is he drawing red lines? He had a 90-minute phone conversation with Putin. And I don't understand what these red lines could be. I mean, it seems to me that this is Russia's sphere of influence. I don't know where we can draw these red lines. So what advice would you give Putin? I mean, Obama?
You need to show sympathy with Russia's concerns. There is a large Russian minority in Ukraine. Crimea has autonomy, which needs to be strengthened. The lease for the naval air station in Sevastopol goes to 2042. That needs to be reaffirmed. So those are positive validations of Russia's concerns. But at the same time, Russia is not going to protect its minority and realize autonomy and get its security by acting the way it does. So you need to make clear what is normative behavior and have the international community acting in consort to let Putin know what the costs are going to be. I mean, the Russian stock market tumbled 13% today. The Russian people don't want to have a war in Ukraine. They certainly don't want to cross swords with NATO. So at what point is Putin just completely out of step with his own oligarchs and his own population? It seems to me that we're fast approaching that point.
Right, but if NATO gets involved, isn't that a reviving a kind of Cold War confrontation? What possible use would that kind of military threat be?
So I'm not suggesting that there be military action. I'm suggesting that NATO show solidarity, that it set up a monitoring mechanism, that it takes steps to deepen the integration of Ukraine into Euro-Atlantic institutions, which include NATO as well as the Eastern European Partnership and Neighborhood Initiative. I mean, there are a lot of tools that the international community can bring to bear to show solidarity with Kiev, to express sympathy with Russia's concerns, but also to be firm and resolute that you can't have this kind of aggression. It breaks down the international system. And if you allow it in one place, then Putin will continue to push the envelope until Russia's aggression is stopped someplace else.
Well, it just to my mind, that all of those things would be counterproductive. The only thing that could probably deter Putin would be the fact that he could start a guerrilla war in the Ukraine, and his own people would be revolted by the idea of Russians killing Ukrainians who they have very close ties with. It seems to me that the less saber rattling we do, the better off we are.
So we haven't done very much saber rattling. You know, there are diplomatic initiatives that can be taken, but you know, keep in mind that there is a Muslim Tatar minority in Crimea. Mm-hmm. There are radical Muslims in Dagestan and Chechnya. If the Muslim minority in Crimea will have their rights taken away from them, what's to say that they themselves don't become radicalized? And then Russia has another front of radical Islam that it has to deal with. Mm-hmm. Putin will stop when he recognizing it's in Russia's interest to stop. You know, we have to make the case why it's in his interest and let him know what the costs are. Some of those costs are to be paid internationally. Other costs are domestic. We just need to make the case and be resolute and strong, because that's the only way that you can deal with tyrants and dictators.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, David Phillips.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University, and the author of Liberating Kosovo, Coercive Diplomacy and U.S. Intervention. He has worked as a senior advisor to the United Nations Secretariat and as a foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the United States Department of State. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Putin's Calculus in Ukraine. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with an analyst of popular culture discussing this year's winners in the Academy Awards. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Toby Miller, who is one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. His books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Capture the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, Greening the Media, and Blow Up the Humanities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Miller.
It's good to be with you.
And the Academy Awards appeared to have favored this year, I guess it's a sci-fi film, Gravity, that won most of the awards. And the films that didn't win any or any significant ones were American Hustle, Nebraska, and The Wolf of Wall Street, all of which had fairly prominent and unequivocal political and cultural themes. So I'm wondering about what this is saying about the Academy and its take on popular culture.
Well, the first thing I'd say to that is that we need to acknowledge that the Academy did recognize the importance of 12 Years a Slave, and that in and of itself is very political because of its take on U.S. history and contemporaneity. And, of course, it's notable that the director said last night that he wanted us to think about not just surviving but living, and he wanted us to think in particular of the over 21 million people enslaved today. But it's true that other than that, the political films that you mentioned were not really touched on with favor by the Academy. And obviously, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences is comprised of high-level professionals who are upper middle class in many cases, though not all of them. They frequently have quite high educational attainment. They are probably liberal in many cases when it comes to cultural politics of sex, of race, of sexuality, gender, and so forth. They may be reasonably liberal economically, but are they really people who are prepared to look at the institutionalized graft and corruption of everyday American life and the systematic inequality of class that pervades it? Perhaps not with quite the same interest that they are to looking at science fiction or with the way in which they're prepared to acknowledge the racism of the country.
Well, I thought that Nebraska was one of the most powerful indictments of red state rural America in the sense that it almost portrayed a dead zone, a cultural, spiritual, and material dead zone where these sad characters are chasing a chimera of the American dream.
Well, of course, that's a long-standing theme in Hollywood, the desire for the American dream and the improbability of ever quite attaining it. And there's also a long-standing tendency in popular culture to think about the Midwest as, on the one hand, the real heartland of the country, where real Americans live, unlike people like you and me who have tended to reside on the coasts, but also for it to be regarded as, in a sense, a hopeless case. And there is a very Depression-era style narrative that frequently makes the play. And of course, you think about Nebraska in the context of Death of a Salesman, a long-standing capacity on the part of American culture, regardless of its geographical location, to invest in the dream in ways that see a particular kind of masculinity, particularly white masculinity, tripping, stumbling, and falling. But whether or not now is the time to be celebrating that tragedy, just when the country appears, at least in part, to be pulling out of the recession, may be one of the factors militated against Nebraska. Well, now, in the case of American Hustle, I wonder what you thought about that, since it clearly is also something that is a startling indictment, but not just of red state America, of every state America.
And indeed, it is also, I think, at least inequality, which is very much the theme or at least the subtext of The Wolf of Wall Street, and the extent to which the oligarchs have bought our politics is, I think, very clear in American Hustle. I think those things are in the zeitgeist.
I think that's absolutely true, and of course they have been for a very long time. The great challenge is always to take the negativity of a depiction of corruption and then turn it into something more positive, rather than have it simply feed the nihilistic notion that there's no point in politics, that everybody's out for themselves, everybody's corrupt, and no one is motivated by altruism. And one of the interesting things about American Hustle is that there are characters within it who certainly are flawed and are corrupt, but who are not just that, who are trying to be something else, something different, but for whom this is part of everyday politics. So the character played by Jeremy Renner, who is the local mayor in New Jersey, the mayor of Camden, is on the take in the interest of his family, but is genuinely pan-racial and cross-class in his desire to better the lives of the people who make up the city that he runs, in inverted commas, and is even, in a sense, entrapped, despite his reluctance to be involved in corruption in certain ways. And, you know, the protagonist of the film, in many ways, the mastermind of all of this, is the guy who, in the end, wishes to do something altruistic to minimize the damage done to the mayor of Camden. And that Christian Bale character, the mastermind, sets himself up from the beginning of the film as a first-person narrator, as someone who is only out for himself. But that's not actually the case. He learns a certain humility and decency along the way. So one of the things about it is that, in addition to its negativity, there is a positive side to it, rather like what you would get with a New Deal era film in the 30s and 40s, where Frank Capra, though a determined Republican, nevertheless saw the need to give the possibility of redemption and decency in amongst the fallibility of politics. Wolf of Wall Street, of course, a very, very contemporary picture, in that at one level it's something that you could associate with what you saw in the Michael Douglas Wall Street, Greed is Good, Gordon Gekko character, and certainly it has all the Reagan-era hallmarks. On the other, it's of course something that we've seen non-stop with the neoliberal domination of political economic life, basically since the end of the Carter administration, you know, whether the president's name is Obama or Clinton or Bush. And that notion of get rich quick and devil take the hindmost, with lots of drugs, lots of parties, lots of girls, lots of boys, is something that lots of us find really quite appealing, even as there's a countervailing aspect to it that is distasteful. And again, though, I think it's done in a contradictory and quite interestingly dialectical way. After all, the United States is certainly a country that stands for hedonism in the world's imagination. Otherwise, how could it be such a massive consumer of drugs? On the other hand, it stands in the world's imagination as the symbol of some kind of entirely mad Christian rectitude. So those schizoid responses to the stimulus of capitalism and the prospects of the new world are undoubtedly interesting, very dialectical moments of encounter in Wolf of Wall Street and in American Hustle.
Well, indeed, it does. I've always thought that America has a schizophrenia between piety and porn. But again,
well put.
Again, I'm speaking with Toby Miller, who is one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. His books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Capture the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, Greening the Media, and Blow Up the Humanities. Let's turn to we're talking about films that didn't get the awards in the Academy Awards, the 2013 Academy Awards that just took place. In terms of documentary features, there were some very political documentary features this year, and they conspicuously did not win Dirty War and The Square about Tahrir Square, and Dirty Wars, of course, about JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command. They failed, and a film about backup singers won. Any significance to that in terms of our conversation?
Well, I think it's great that they even got nominated. Jeremy Scahill, who is the Enos, not particularly grease, behind Dirty Wars, is a radical journalist in the United States firmament. He's obviously very important in terms of his writing for places like The Nation and also his radio journalism. And the fact that somebody with his take on the corruption and the imperialism endemic in the U.S. military project says something about the capacity of the Academy, particularly those people involved in documentary, to recognize both the qualities of the picture but also the urgency of people being urged to address such questions. So I think we can say at least it was on the list, and it's a radical enterprise in itself. In the case of The Square, this is a very interesting instance. Obviously, it's dealing in very complicated ways with the extraordinary phenomenon of the so-called Arab Spring. I say so-called because it's gone on for such a long time, but it's also been interrupted in so many ways. And this is also interesting because not only is that a phenomenally complicated political place and moment, far beyond the ken of most of us who don't speak Arabic and have ethnographic experience as well as historical knowledge there, it's also very innovative in terms of its life story as a motion picture, as a documentary, because it's a Netflix film, and as such was quite regularly updated over the period of the last couple of years to stay, you know, in tune with events. That's not something that you could do with documentaries before, but because of the way Netflix produces them, you can now. That makes it a complicated aesthetic object, a bit like the way in which different versions of Leni Riefenstahl's Olympia or even Orson Welles' Citizen Kane change over time as different versions are released in different countries at different moments or a cut or whatever. Here we have a motion picture that is constantly being updated as the political crisis in Egypt evolves, and also one where, you know, we see in this case one of the major figures in the film unable to come to the United States, unable to leave Egypt as a consequence of the political regime's view of his activities. It may well be that rather than this being a slight on the politics of the film, it's also partly that some voters in the Academy aren't quite sure what to make of this. This is such a dynamic, open-ended story, one that is constantly being re-edited, renovated, reconsidered. That, you know, what is the version you're actually contemplating? Where does it end? How does it cut off? And how do you define it? And I think that shows that we're in a moment of both technological and political economic change where an entity like Netflix is not only coming to challenge the way in which broadcast and cable and satellite television function in the United States, but is also redefining our notion of when a film begins and ends.
Well, there's no question that Netflix, its model of making television in terms of House of Cards, where they just write a check to the filmmakers and leave them alone, is entirely in contrast with how these corporate bureaucracies operate, with legions of vice presidents vetting scripts and giving their ridiculous script notes to directors and micromanaging casting, etc. And we end up with the kind of dreck that we have on television and in movies, contrasting to some of the really interesting stuff that's coming out on television now, like House of Cards. So I don't imagine the corporate bureaucracies are going to change and going to suddenly fire all of their legions of vice presidents.
Well, of course, it's not only a matter of cutting out some of the bureaucracy. It's also giving us as viewers a great deal more autonomy in that not only can the people who make House of Cards get cut a check, but we get cut a lot of slack in that once we've made the purchase from Netflix, we can watch every bloody episode in a row if we want to. Not something that is seizable with broadcast or cable or satellite television until at least one season has already been run through. So that's a remarkable thing too, and we may see lots of changes in the definition of what counts as a film as part of that.
Sure.
And of course, funding regimes matter and change also. Many of the motion pictures that get nominated, for instance, for Best Foreign Film are essentially funded with television money. even though we don't see them in that way. I mean, the whole world of new German cinema, people will remember from the 1980s, the world that made the names of Wim Wenders and Fassbinder renowned to so many of us, may have been seen in universities and on festival circuits in the United States or in Western Europe or in Latin America, but in Germany, those movies were seen on television because that was what, how they were funded. And the sobriquet New German Cinema was, in a sense, a laughable term. It was New German television. So there are lots of complicated definitional questions for us to consider. And, you know, the requirement that films must have theatrical release in order to count to be nominated and then voted for in the Oscars, a theatrical release within a certain window, maybe something that we see as a hangover from the 20th century that no longer applies. We'll mm-hmm. see. I think there are all kinds of shifts that occur in the nature of the awards, so the very definition of the awards may be under challenge.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, let me give you my most surreal moment from the Academy Awards, and then I'll ask. Then you can offer yours. I thought the most surreal moment was when Lupita Nyong'o won the Best Actress in a Supporting Role for 12 Years a Slave. When she got up to get her award, suddenly, out of nowhere, Liza Minnelli, who clearly didn't know this woman, rushes up and hugs her. So, what was your most surreal moment?
Yes, that was an interesting one. I think for me, it's the selfie and the, in other words, the right. self-taken photograph that, you know, smashed Twitter records and showed that a selfie taken at the Oscars can matter more than President Obama on Twitter. It also shows that the very beautifully and professionally done photography everywhere from the Oscars themselves to the after parties takes a back footing, a back seat to what celebrities do themselves. And I wonder whether the dominant still photograph of Oscar season will not be the cover of Vanity Fair or any of the photographs taken at the Vanity Fair party, but rather the one taken by Ellen DeGeneres with all her, in inverted commas, friends. That's a telling moment of narcissism that both American culture, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, are well renowned for.
Well, Toby Miller, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Toby Miller, who is one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. His books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Capture the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, Greening the Media, and Blow Up the Humanities. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.